Hi, and welcome to the Birth Visionary Podcast, where we talk tools, resources, and taking action with birth workers and maternal health advocates committed to social justice and systemic change. We help you get clear about your vision and values so you can lead with authenticity and intention in your unique work. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of the Birth Visionary Podcast. I am so excited today to have Jen Atkinson, who is a certified perinatal nurse and educator with a Master's of Science in Clinical Nurse Leadership from the University of Portland. She has practiced in hospitals, birth centers, and public health clinics for the past 15 years, supporting thousands of patients as they move through the birth process. Jen is also an expert witness in birth injury litigation. She believes in the power of trauma-aware practices to bring joy back into our professional lives and allow us to have the meaningful patient relationships we all went into healthcare originally to have. Helping nurses uncenter their fears and reconnect to their professional identity as a patient advocate is her personal mission. Welcome, Jen. So thrilled to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm super excited to be here.
Wonderful. I would love to just start right away with what brought you to this passion around trauma-informed care and trauma-informed education in obstetrics, in labor and delivery?
I have definitely a more unusual path, maybe not. I guess we'll find out. But, you know, earlier, I think we were talking and you asked like, oh, did you get training in this or take a class or something like this? And I kind of fell into it. So I'm a labor and delivery nurse, and I was found myself, I guess the only easy way to say it is, so I had to leave a marriage because of domestic violence. And as I was entering a new relationship, a current relationship, I was realizing all of these things were coming up for me as I was trying to enter this new relationship. And it's with my current partner now, and he's amazing and stuff like that. But I was sitting in my office, I was having a lot of insomnia because part of the violence and the abuse in my previous marriage was what happened in the middle of the night, you know, being awakened. That person struggled with a substance use disorder. And so, you know, sleeping and nighttime now with this new partner was really, really activating to me. And so I wasn't sleeping. I was finding myself with a lot of stress and like flashbacks and things like that. And I was talking to one of the midwives at work, and she was like, and I was like, when do I need, at what point do I get medication for this, right? Like, I need to sleep. It was pretty bad. And I wanted to not, I could see that like my ability to move forward with this really new, amazing relationship was going to be jeopardized unless I could put some pieces back together for myself. And so she actually recommended a woman. I reach out to a coach and therapist named Shelby Lee, who is a trauma specialist. And so I did. And as I started to learn all of the things to do to heal my own trauma, like I couldn't help but see the parallels. Like, I mean, it was like session one. And then the next day I had a clinical academy training for our new OB nurses. And automatically I started to see these parallels between, you know, how the things I was learning and the tools I was getting to heal my own trauma and how much sense that made when we talk about the birth world, nursing culture, how we train and teach nurses. And it just, I don't know, so many pieces started clicking for me. And so not maybe the most traditional way, but yeah. And it's, I think, one of those things where you don't expect someone to say domestic violence set me on my current professional journey. But in fact, it did. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for being vulnerable enough to share that story, because as you know, I'm sure you know that when we share our experience in such a vulnerable way, it's helping more than one person who's listening to this podcast right now. And probably for listeners of the podcast right now, they're their minds are being blown a bit around the parallels related to something like your described experience of domestic violence and how that can't, there are parallels in their professional life and what they're experiencing. You know, I'm specifically thinking about how you mentioned that there were, you know, certain environments or things that are triggering to you, and how I'm assuming that can be mimicked in a professional space and bring about those same nervous system activation pieces, right?
Would you right. say? Yeah. So how, one, I do want to like say, yeah, I am being a much more vocal about it, because I think something that took me by surprise when I finally realized kind of what was happening was I'd always been, you know, I'd watched the Lifetime movies, or we got classes on, you know, safe relationships and stuff like that. But it was always, the idea was, it was this woman who was, you know, looked a certain way or had a certain background, and it wasn't me. Like, I had a master's degree, you know, I didn't get married too early, all of these things. And I was the charge nurse, so I didn't admit patients very often. And I found myself just one day jumping in when my son was about one, asking the domestic violence screening questions. And so I'm asking, you know, have you been like kicked or punched, or have you been choked, or have you, all of these questions that we have to ask. And I'm just hearing myself inside going, yep, 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 yep. And I just remember that moment being like, ah, shit. like I knew it was bad, but I was sort of like, I'm strong, I'm tough, I can figure this out. And so with the parallels between domestic violence, I do want to say, I think it's probably, nurses are very ripe for that, for those types of relationships. And I don't know, you know, why that is, but there's really are parallels. And I can just already imagine the comments coming back, but like, go with me on this parallel. But like, you know, sometimes in violent relationships where this one person's really, you're walking on eggshells, or you're trying to keep the peace, or, you know, maybe you try and keep the kids more quiet or reduce the stress of the environment. And sometimes how nurses act to sort of keep the peace on a unit or with providers or with system culture, like, you know, oh, I got to keep the kids quiet. Well, the patient is, you know, sometimes we might inadvertently try to get patients to do things so that we don't have to rock the boat with providers or things. We can sort of abdicate our role in advocacy because we are feeling like we're choosing between maybe our own safety in a work environment and being a patient, being a true patient advocate. And so I don't know, you know, which way this always flows, but, you know, I do think it's probably much more common than we realize that there are nurses mm-hmm. who are in relationships with, you know, big power differentials mm-hmm. or dynamics around it.
Wow. Wow. I mean, a few things are standing out for me. When you said, you know, you thought that you were able to, you're tough, you're able to figure this out. That's one thing. Those are traits that I think are really admirable traits. Like when you think of, I'm not a nurse, but I work with a lot of nurses and a lot of healthcare professionals. And those are personality traits that are upheld in a medical environment, I would say, right? So mm-hmm. the ability to figure it out, the ability to stay tough, work through whatever's going on. And then also this idea of controlling your environment to reduce the potential for trauma. I'm thinking about how that can be so traumatizing in and of itself, because I think, you know, just speaking for myself and situations I've been in, it's self-denial. So you're denying on one sense, and it's this very hard stuff, but denying on one level, your own feelings and physical comfort in a space that is at the expense, you know, keeping that down, squelching that is kind of at the expense of maintaining or trying to control the overall harmony of an environment to keep things from going a certain way. And, you know, that's something that I've had to come to learn the hard way. But those two pieces of what you just said really stood out for me, because I can see those parallels for sure in the clinical environments I work in, and how it could be tough for, I think, someone to first identify what's going on, just as you said, in the parallels of domestic violence situations, and then to recognize what's going on for you internally and then acting on that in some way. I mean, that's really tough stuff to navigate. So again, I appreciate you sharing.
That's why you need a trauma therapist.
right. And amazing people. And thank you for shouting yours out. If she's okay with it, we'll put it in the show notes as one resource.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, that as we're talking, I'm thinking that I need to edit my website to have some resources, some trauma-informed therapist resources listed on there as well. Yeah.
So she and I worked together and it was again, like I said, like every week I was learning a new thing, a new principle, a new part of understanding my own nervous system. And like it literally happened within one visit the very next day. I was already able to start putting some of this stuff to use in my role as an educator at the hospital. And so, I mean, and that's how we are, right? Especially birth people. It's like, it's all linked and we can't help ourselves. Right. It's like most people be like, yeah, just take some time for yourself and figure all this out. And meanwhile, I'm like, how can I make it better for nurses? Right. Which is always how we go. Yeah. But like one of the very first things that she taught me was just, you know, to talk more slowly. And when we are like retelling a story of something that's really scary that's happened. And so in my case, I'm recounting, you know, the things that had happened to me in the past, you know, getting woken up in the middle of the night by this, you know, intoxicated person. And when we start retelling stories, we tend to try and tell them really fast because we want to get through it, right? We want to get through it. But our bodies, our nervous systems don't know whether it's currently happening or it's already happened. And so if we will keep telling these stories really quickly. And so in the case of these new nurses, the next day at this clinical academy is what we call it, where I work, they're recounting, this one starts telling me about this scary situation she had. And she's telling it so fast, so fast, because she's trying to get through it. Well, that's keeps imprinting back on our nervous systems. And so I said, I'm like, I got to stop you. And I explained this to her and you could just see they're all the little light bulbs because it's an easy concept, right? I was like, just tell me the story slower. And as she did, you could just feel everybody like in the room. And now that memory they reorient to those memories because we know trauma isn't the event, it's how it's stored in the body. And just by retelling these scary events slower, can make a big difference on how they land in our body. And so, right, just taking something that simple then I got so curious about like, well, how have we been doing our simulations or how have we been doing, you know, our strip reviews or our hemorrhage education or, you know, all of those things that we do in the environment. And I think as educators, we tend to want to, we maybe have been trained of like, throw everything at them. This is their one chance to get it all down and da 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 da. And, but now with this new lens of trauma, these trauma-informed care practices that I was learning, I was like, I can't do that anymore. Like I can't teach that way. And noticing what a big difference and shift it's made in the education and like the nervous systems, quite frankly, of the staff has been really amazing.
That is so powerful. I mean, just the simple, not so simple, simple act of slowing down to tell a story with traumatic elements, you're saying actually has the ability for it impacts the way our bodies process that trauma or allows it lands differently is what I'm hearing when those stories are told. I'm thinking of the book, The Body Keeps the Score. I forget the name of the classic book about trauma, right? Embodied trauma. But that is so just, and you seeing the results. So you're a nurse educator, clearly. Is that primarily what you're doing now?
I do that. I do still work a little bit at the bedside. I'm going to be moving all the way back to the bedside and leaving my like hospital educator role at the end of this year. I'm going to still keep doing some stuff, but I just miss patient care too much. So I think I've worked it out where I can get to do a little bit of both. And then, as you said in my intro, like I do expert witness work as well. But in my main kind of day-to-day hospital job, I'm the clinical educator.
Excellent. So you have seen the impact of these trauma-informed techniques in your role as educator. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, and once you kind of hear, it's one of those things where it's like, once you hear it or you see it, you're like, I can't unsee that. Or it's like, oh my gosh, it makes so much sense. So like, for instance, with simulations, a lot of places they tend to do them kind of here and there. It's not consistent. And when they do happen, most people are like, most nurses will say like, I don't really like simulation. Like it's chaotic. It doesn't feel real. They say all of these things about it. But I think what's underneath of it is that it's unpredictable, which we know, like making as many things predictable as possible in this environment for the nurses is one way as an educator, you can, help their nervous systems, right? To help to prevent any preventable amounts of workplace trauma, which by the way, like something like 60% of nurses have moderate to severe burnout and symptoms of PTSD. And it's super high in the birth world and with birth workers. And so that's why, I mean, as a nurse having to, as a nurse educator, you know, my patients in quotes are the nurses. And so just like a nurse is going to try and modify the care environment to make it feel as safe and as predictable and as whatever for the patient, like I'm trying to do that for the staff. And so making things predictable or with simulations, the very first simulation was just a simulation and simulation. Like, when you take your kid to the doctor and what does the doctor do? They like give them the stethoscope to look at. They give them the thermometer to look at, the eye, the ear thing. And they let the kid look at it and really like look around the room and stuff. And that's what's called orienting. So we just started with orienting to the space, right? Touch the sim doll, it was a neonatal sim. So touch the warmer, touch the fake things that are all real things that you guys see every day, but we don't take that time with our nurses because we're like, oh, you're an adult, you're a professional. I can throw all this stuff at you. And again, things that are really venerated in our profession. And then the next, and we also do our simulations really slowly. Cause again, it's that idea of like, the way we say things, but also the motions we take. Well, the next time they're in that, they'll be able to slow themselves down. They won't feel that chaotic feeling. So, you know, our simulations can either it reinforce that these are traumatic events or these are scary events, or they can reinforce like, I've got this, this is slow, I can remain calm, all those things. And we're really just training their nervous systems with simulations now, not so much their, it's sort of like how athletes will like walk through the race really, really slowly, right? Well, they can run it fast, but they practice it super slow. And that's how, you know, simulations can either be traumatizing or really resilience building for staff.
That is so powerful and fascinating. And I can't help but think of the parallels to raising kids. Because just last night in our house, I was having a super chaotic night where I had to do some work. I typically try to end my work by 3 or 4 when the kids are home, but I had this, I was kind of moving frantically all over the house. I was, you know, throwing dinner on the table. It was not our normal calm routine. And the kids pick up on that. And I feel like, and I was so aware in the moment that me moving rapidly through these tasks, very unhappy, nervous about work and, you know, frantically kind of doing this thing is rubbing off on them. And then it mimics in their behavior. And I kept thinking to myself, I don't want every evening to feel stressful to them because this is the way I'm behaving when I have to do work. And I always think about how is this imprinting on them or training them and their bodies and their little minds to think that this is stressful time in our house. And I can't, right. I just can't help but think about, the parallels around and the impact and the power of moving through a situation intentionally in a more grounding way, like you say, touch all the things, orient yourself to the space for when things are really, you know, you're in that professional situation where there is a crisis, there is a serious situation, how then your body and your nervous system is trained to to handle it differently than if we were learning at a more rapid pace or more frantically or beginning from a stressed out point of view or perspective.
Yeah. I mean, we're always co-regulating, right, with the people around us. And I mean, and I think that's the amazing thing because, I mean, a lot of us have, you know, relationship wounds or relationship traumas and things like that. Well, we're hurt in relationships. We also heal in relationships, whether it's with now your own children, whether it's with your coworkers. So through this, I've really noticed like when we go to debrief, like actual events, you can see it really play out because two nurses who were there will tell you, one will say, it was the worst thing ever. No one came to help us. It was, you know, all of these things. And then the other one will say like, I don't know, you know, it was da da da. And then the supervisor came and then we resolved it, but we always had it under control. And this was a real conversation that happened for me at work, like maybe a year or two ago. And I'm looking at these two nurses and I'm like, well, which one was it? And then I'm realizing like, oh, it was both. It was very, very real in one way for one and very real with the other one. Well, one maybe just has more like trauma or hasn't had that ability to start building their resiliency or reorienting to some of these other past experiences. So now every experience is going to continue to feel that way. And so, you know, I'm not trying to like gaslight nurses into being like, is it really scary and terrible? Or you just need more resiliency? Like, that's not what I'm saying. But like, we've all worked with those staff who it can be a fairly like maybe normal shift and it'll be like, they might interpret it one way versus the other. But yeah, like what you're saying with kids, I always have to catch myself that too. But my son is a very like, he's a funny kid. He's highly emotional, intelligent. And then he'll be like a totally normal 7-year-old, you know, like that. But it's just like, Mom, I'm feeling like you're not feeling too well right now, which is his, like how he sees me when I'm kind of, yeah, doing the same thing, like, you know, flying around the house. And then you're realizing like, yeah, what message is this saying? And the same thing at work is just that co-regulation and how we're able to like regulate our own nervous systems. And then I can be a more regulating force maybe for like the nurses that I work with or, because then they're learning how to co-regulate with patients that way as well. So
the power of presence, I mean, just your presence and being in check of your own energy and your own awareness. I think people really underestimate at times the power of that by just being a calm, regulated presence as much as possible in the midst of chaos and how we take cues from one another. Like you said, and I love what you said, how that we can heal together. Because I think there is often a lot of focus on all the negative pieces in the, you know, in our own personal relationships and interprofessional relationships. But this emphasis around, you know, we can also heal together is incredibly powerful and not, I don't think it's discussed enough.
Yeah. I mean, I can't say enough for the healing power of a relationship. My current partner, Joseba, you know, it was one of the hardest things to say to him, you know, to share like some of this trauma and like, you know, describing like, I've got, you know, this is what's going on for me. And for him to just, I can always ask him to like breathe with me or be still with me for a minute or something like that. And so having to have like coworkers who understand these principles, having a partner, they're incredibly, mm-hmm. nurturing and healing. And so, and I know nurses often will talk about like, we also don't tend to have these support systems. And so, you know, a recent study, it was actually a poll on Nurse Life RN back before EB, passed away. And it was saying like, who's got support at home, who do you talk to? And the vast majority of nurses said that they had no one outside of coworkers to discuss workplace trauma with. And so they weren't going home to these partners who were people that could hold space for them in that way. And so, as much as I wish everybody could have a fine, supportive man like mine, I can't like start that dating service.
Oh God.
I can't send everybody's partners to therapy, but right. But we can also start to do these things. We can start to be, relationship healers amongst ourselves at work. Because it's one of those things where like, well, we don't have it be outside of work, but sometimes, but we often, we don't have people inside of work because of the culture of nursing. Mm-hmm, And so just making our educational space as a place to start doing that work has been really important for me.
Absolutely. Oh, and I wish we could clone you, because I move in and out a lot of clinical educational spaces. And I can tell you that is not my common experience of being in those spaces. So I mean, on a professional level, I'm just so, and a personal level, so grateful for the work that you do and your investment in trauma-informed practices. So if it's all right with you, let's switch gears for a second, because I know I shared this with you when I was talking to a couple of folks, letting them know that I was going to be recording with you today. And I was talking about your bio. The first thing everybody wanted to know about was your experience as an expert witness in birth injury cases. So I'm curious, like, what brought you to that? And can you tell us a little bit about what it's been like working in the, you know, the expert witness area around birth injury with birth?
Yeah, it's a large portion of my professional life now. I was just tidying up. I've got like 60 active cases right now. I'm reviewing in like 30 plus different states. And the way I got into it is just, there's a nurse, she was nearing retirement. And so she was working at our hospital on call, and she did this work, you know, just, she was like, well, I'll just be on call at this little cute hospital out in Oregon City. And we became friends, and I asked her about it, and she's like, oh yeah, I'm kind of, you know, nearing the end of my career. And she showed me the ropes, and that's kind of how I got into it. The first case I ever reviewed though was really eye-opening, because in our hospital world, there's no time that we get that same perspective, sort of that 30,000 foot view of, you know, prenatal, the birth process, maybe in the hospital, and then to the baby or the kids, like 2, 3, 4 years old. Because most of the time I see these cases when the child, if it's like a birth injury for the neonate, around that 3 or 4 year age mark. And the perspective it gave me was just so eye-opening. You know, we go to work, we pass off our patient, maybe we're off, we might be off for like a week even sometimes, depending on how the schedule, and then you come back and you might never know that something happened unless there is a lawsuit. And to see like, oh man, that piece that I didn't report or that thing I didn't catch up on really made a difference. And I did crawl into bed for about 2 weeks, because I was like, have I hurt somebody? And there'd be no way we could even know. And in fact, when there is an injury, everything goes on lockdown, right? And we aren't supposed to talk about it. And the whole birth injury and like litigation process is really hard on nurses. There's a lot of secondary trauma just through that process. You know, dealing with lawyers is always scary. We want to say, I'm sorry, or, but we don't know how, or we're told not to, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a definitely, and then as I was reviewing, and I've reviewed, you know, a couple hundred cases now, I started seeing these really big commonalities, and they were absolutely not what I was taught in risk management classes about what kept us safe and not safe. And the way this is always talked about in the birth world, well, one, it's like, and just an accepted part of our professional life, this like fear, in quotes, like fear of getting sued, which is so weird, right? It's so like, why is that? We just accept that's how it is. And so I was just like, well, you know, so then of course at the nurse's station, people would say like, well, if you get pulled into the court of law, and I just kind of started being like, you guys, that's not how it works. Or, you know, cause I was pretty quiet about it for a long time. And now that people know I do this, I feel like it's all, it is all that people want to talk about, cause it's this huge fear. And it does, I think it's definitely the, at least a, it's either a symptom of or a source of a lot of trauma that nurses carry, that birth nurses carry, is either they've been through this process or they're afraid of going through this process. Is this fear of getting sued really drives a lot of the trauma that nurses have, and how that fear is wielded against them. And then in turn, how they try to, again, control these environments, control these patients to try and keep themselves in a feeling of safety, kind of under the guise of patient safety. But because we have it really convoluted, it ends up being a thing that traumatizes patients too, or can be, we're unregulated and fearful, so we can inadvertently, and traumatize, so we can inadvertently traumatize patients because of this fear. So yeah, talking about this, but maybe in a different way, is definitely become a personal, I don't know, vendetta, mission, whatever we want to call it. Yeah.
Well, I see this issue of fear of being sued, fear of litigation with physicians all the time. Because when I get called for an ethics consult, I would say 8 times out of 10, some of the first words out of a physician's mouth are, hey, I think I know where I want to go with this case, but I need it rubber stamped by ethics for the legal aspect, or to get my, to make sure I'm covered legally. And it's it takes a tremendous amount of education on my part to first tell them, hey, ethics is not the legal department. Number one, what is legal is not always moral, and vice versa. So that's a whole other thing to kind of unpack. But I hear it so often where I get calls mostly from physicians initially, and they'll say, I just don't want to be sued. Tell me if I'm doing the right thing or not. And you can hear the fear in their voice. And it tells me two things. It tells me they're not fully educated around the role of ethics in the hospital. And secondly, but maybe not most importantly or most significantly, they are just so fearful of being sued, and that is dictating their process with this patient and the way they're interacting with the patient and the course of care that's being prescribed, which is not, I would argue, not always in the best interest of the patient. So it's a really tricky, I mean, that fear, like right. You said, that fear as a driver is never helpful. And this is a perfect example of a situation right. Where it's not.
Yeah.
Definitely not.
No, you want, I mean, fear is always going to come along on that car ride with us, right? But it's whether it's mm-hmm. driving the car or it's just like slurping a soda in the backseat that we got at this moment. Right. So, cause it's like we can't ever not have, we should have fear, right? This is like, that we should have some level of vigilance or some way of checking ourselves and not being cavalier, right? So fear is not, I wouldn't say a bad thing, but we just don't want it, especially this type of fear, we don't want it in the driver's seat. And so when we hear like risk management classes or managers or educators be like, you know, they love to say in the court of law, well, first of all, in my whatever couple hundred cases, I've never been to court. They always settle. Like, so if you going to court, cross it off, it's not going to happen. But it's the things that they say that are protective against that, to me, just always blow my mind. You know, I think they say that and you're kind of like, well, we could just talk about patient safety, because that's really what this is, right? And we know how to keep patients safe. You know, we do shared decision making. We have informed consent. We, you know, are grounded in, you know, our physiology and our knowledge and things like that. And we build these therapeutic relationships with patients, so we know how to keep them safe. But they, yeah, it's sort of this under this guise of not getting sued. And sometimes I wonder if they're like, do they not think we know that this is important, or, you know, that they have to scare us into patient safety, as opposed to coming at these topics. Like, we do need to talk about, you know, the legal world, all of these things, the things that are patient injury, super real. We have a mortality and morbidity crisis in this country. And we have a specifically one that's driven by, you know, systemic racism and the impacts that that's having on our Black and our Brown communities and our Indigenous communities. And so do we need to talk about it? Like, Yes, 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 yes. But we can't have our, like, our fear can't be the center of that or be the driving force in that conversation. Like, because we, you know, one thing people don't realize is like, we don't have risk, right? Like, I don't go to the hospital and incur risk as a nurse. Like, I have liability and I have a duty, but I have no risk. The person with the risk is the patient's baby, their body, they have the risk. And so when we have these conversations around like getting sued, it's really centering our fear versus when we're talking about patient safety, then we're centering, you know, the patient and the real person who's actually, you know, carrying all of the risk, the actual risk, the bodily harm that can come to them. So one of my now is like, well, Jen, you're this trauma aware educator, but then you love talking about this really traumatizing thing around like legal issues. And so navigating that has been definitely like a fun, interesting, challenging endeavor. And I think I'm doing it, I hope. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's just a super, I mean, I know being an expert witness on the whole, like there are plenty of people to do that, but I think you're the first first labor and delivery nurse that I've spoken to that works as an expert witness on specifically birth injury cases. So, and I think, you know, it's great for people to hear that this is another aspect of the work that you're doing and how it informs your thinking, how it informs your role as educator and the way that you interact with patients moving forward. So I think it's an incredibly valuable perspective to share. So, so thank you for saying a bit about that. And it also makes it real. I mean, for folks that might be listening, I don't think it's probably a lot of this audience, but for folks who are listening and maybe thinking, how often does birth injury really occur? And how often do these cases go to court? It sounds like pretty freaking often, right? Based on what you're saying. I mean, this is a part of your career right now. So
yeah. I wouldn't say it's, you know, it's super region specific. It's super, right? Like, people with more birth injury areas with higher levels of, well, we know birth injury is a thing. We know that 2/3 of it at least is preventable. And where the standard of care comes in, you know, it is, I would say it can happen, but it is also highly preventable. Like, right. We're not, that's one of the sort of the tropes that you hear around this, or that nurses feel like they're, one of their more specific fears is that I'm a good, caring, kind nurse, and this is something that could, that I could do something completely unknowingly and cause harm and get sued, and it's out of my control. Well, it's actually really in our control. Like, most of the statistics are that, that frivolous lawsuits don't happen. We know that there is this mortality and morbidity crisis in our country. And so, you know, I think people are like, they can hear those statistics and think, oh my God, that's awful news. And I hear that, I'm like, that's freaking amazing news, because it means we're not, you know, at the hands of fate, and we can do things to take control over that. Mm-hmm. And you know, how we can talk about that can be a really resilient building, grounding thing that make us feel more connected to our role of being an advocate versus other types of legal education, I think can, it leaves you feeling scared, or it's, they've thrown all these like maybe tips and tricks at you that don't really like, it's not like a framework. It's not, a way of being, that is a little bit easier to translate into our day-to-day work. So I did create a course for labor and delivery nurses or anybody who works in birth, to learn, you know, more about the process, you know, the real things that I see, the, you know, the sort of the mindset, so that you're leaving this, being able to kind of cross that fear off and get back to the work that we're all wanting to do.
Wonderful. And we're going to link to where folks can access your course and work with you. And
well, it's a wait list right now.
Oh, it's a wait list. Perfect. So we'll provide the link for the wait list, or the best way to let you know that people are interested. So that's amazing to hear that that is happening, because my next question to you was going to be, you know, what's one or two things right now that, you know, nurses listening right now, what's one or two things that they can begin to do to become more trauma aware, start doing that work for the person who is listening and making a lot of real connections based on what you've shared with us today? What are a few things that they can do to get started on doing this work and incorporating it into their professional lives? So you've given us one. You have a course coming up that folks can start to sign up for. What else would you recommend?
I think that, you know, we hear a lot right now around like physiologic birth. I think we kind of know in birth injury, there's really only two types of cases. I mean, I see lots of different, maybe like situations, but when you boil it down, it comes down to like two things. Like we either intervened in normal or we didn't intervene in abnormal. Well, that's tricky because in the clinical world, we've become really misguided on what normal is, right? So to make that determination between is this normal or abnormal and whether I intervene or not, has become, so we're either like intervening all the time in these very normal births, or we've normalized this very abnormal thing. Especially we see this like with fetal monitoring, we'll normalize these really abnormal, you know, oh, category two or three tracings, that's fine. It's fine. Babies come out fine all the time. We normalize that, or all sorts of things, and we don't intervene. And so really what we need to do is get really good at what normal is. And I'm just so surprised when I read like nurse depositions, how many lack like basic fundamental physiologic normal. So I would say the number one thing you can do is like sign up for a physiologic birth class and start making that like a regular thing that you do. I take different physiologic birth class. I teach them and I still take it. And I find I learn something, a little new thing almost every time. Even just this year, you know, I took a spinning babies class and learning, I never really thought so much about like the post-birth physiology, and oh my gosh, it like blew my mind. So I would say, and of course, like the frame of physiologic birth is trauma aware practices. You can't have a physiologic birth if you aren't also practicing trauma awareness as well, right? Because that nervous system is so involved. So I would say that's kind of like the first step. If every nurse could just really hunker down and get super good at normal, we would change the game significantly in a very, very short amount of time. Mm-hmm. We all love like Justine and Sarah at Bundle Birth. You know, they've got a great class. There's certainly others, but there is a whole community of nurses who are engaging in this type of education. And when we talk about legal stuff, we're really talking about the standard of care. And the standard of care is just like what any reasonable and prudent nurse would do. So if you're wondering, my course is called Reasonable and Prudent. So that's why it's what any reasonable and prudent nurse would do. And so that means that the standard of care is not a brick wall, right? It changes. And every day we go to work, we contribute to it. So if suddenly you've got, you know, 20,000 nurses or 30,000 nurses all going to work and practicing physiologic birth, well, what becomes the standard of care? That. And so nurses are incredibly, incredibly powerful. We're not at the hands of fate. We can absolutely change everything that's happening that's wrong with birth here and support everything that's right with birth, like very, very quickly. It's not going to be one of those things that takes, you know, decades. It's not a generational change or anything like that. I mean, it could literally be like next weekend. We could all come to work. Well,
that's a question I love to ask my guests, because there are some people that strongly believe that you cannot change the system. It's too broken and we need to create a completely alternate pathway that to support birthing people. And then there are others who believe that change can happen from within the system. So I'm guessing you're in the camp that we can change things happening within the system if we have these practices that, I don't want to put words
maybe,
in your mouth.
You tell me. I mean, I do work in the system. change will certainly happen to the system, right? But is it like, is it going to be an evolution or a revolution, I guess is like the question. And yeah, I mean, I still see those cardiomyopathy patients come in that absolutely need an ICU and like high levels of care. So I do get why it's hard to think about, like I advocate for, I super support home birth. Like, I think that's should be a well-integrated option in ways that it isn't now. But whether, I don't know. I think that we can have, we need, I think that those can be, it's can be hard for a nurse to be both taking care of your super sick ejection fraction of 20 moms, patients, birthing people. Meanwhile, this absolute, like no monitor, no IV, essential oils, because we actually use essential oils at my hospital, not trying to like say that that's, I'm not, you know, anything like that.
Yeah.
No intervention, no monitoring patient. That's a huge spectrum for nurses to have to be good at. So I get that like an actual option is like, well, maybe then make the system somewhere different where we don't have to be, that's just such a huge spectrum. Like ICU nurses don't take care of normal patients. We take care of everything from like very, very healthy to very, very sick. So that's right. A unique thing about our specialty that I get doesn't make the best sense. So.
Oh, that is a unique thing that I don't think I've heard anyone really emphasize before, that there is such a variation of where your patients are starting from and where they might end up in their journey in your care. I mean, so that's really interesting to note, I think. Jen, I have had such a great time talking to you today. I learned some new things today, that is for sure. And I am so excited to connect with your ongoing work, resources, your course, and to connect all of our listeners to what you're doing. So tell us really quick where people can find you on social media. If you have a website, where can people connect with you?
I've tried to make it very easy. I'm just at Jen Atkison. My website's jenatkison.com. And my course is going to be, we had a beta at the beginning of the year and I learned a lot. So it's going to be bigger, better. We're going to have live calls so that we can like support each other through this learning process. You can get questions answered because as much as I think I'm answering questions, sometimes that can bring up even more questions. So it'll have live calls in it as well. And that course is called Reasonable and Prudent. Because like I said, the standard of care is what reasonable and prudent nurses would do. So we can kind of start to shift and reorient around that language together and kind of hopefully reclaim it a bit, reclaim our role as advocates. But yeah, that's me. That's what I'm up to.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Jen. This has been so great. And I know we'll be connecting in the future for sure.
Okay. Thank you.